ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the Middle East ceasefire remains in jeopardy as Donald Trump sends US Navy ships to blockade Iranian ports. Also, the Prime Minister announces new Defence Force chiefs. For the first time, a woman will lead the army. And one of Bollywood's biggest stars, Asha Bhosle, dies at the age of 92.
She could pour emotion into a ballad and slip effortlessly into pop with a distinctly global sound.
After the failed peace talks between the US and Iran over the weekend, the ceasefire between those countries and Israel remains shaky, with Donald Trump now planning to send US Navy ships to blockade Iranian ports. The president says any Iranians trying to stop the blockade would be, in his words, blown to hell. As it's still looking very unlikely the vital shipping route, the Strait of Hormuz, will reopen anytime soon, pressure is on the Australian government to lock in fuel deals with Asian nations. Angus Randall filed this report.
As peace talks between Iran and the United States collapsed, Donald Trump's supporters waved American, Israeli and Iranian flags through New York City.
President Trump, stay the course. Iran has made his choice.
The US president says he's sending ships to the Strait of Hormuz within hours. His team says they'll be blockading Iranian ports. The partial opening of the strait was a key point in the Iran-US ceasefire agreed upon last week. However, it had been unclear whether Iran would charge a multi-million dollar toll for every ship that passes through the strait, going against the international maritime laws of free and safe passage. Donald Trump says he's not letting Iran pick and choose what ships pass through.
Their promise was that they were going to open the Hormuz Strait. They didn't do it. They lied.
Iran says military vessels approaching the Strait of Hormuz would be a violation of the ceasefire deal. The head of the Iranian Parliament's National Security Commission, Ebrahim Azizi, has his doubts Donald Trump will follow through with the blockade.
He is voicing his own wishes, his dreams and demands that have never been realised and by God's will not be realised.
Donald Trump says NATO allies will be joining in the blockade. However, the United Kingdom says it won't take part in military action. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says Australia also won't be involved.
We haven't been asked to help. What we have done is continue to provide support. I've extended the period of service of our Wedgetail aircraft in the Middle East that's providing defensive support, particularly to the UAE.
With increasing uncertainty over the future of the strait, he'll head to Brunei and Malaysia this week to shore up relations with two of Australia's main energy suppliers.
When it comes to Brunei, they provide about 9% of our diesel, but also are a major supplier of fertiliser. And Malaysia provides the third largest imports to Australia.
The blockade announcement came just hours after negotiations between Iran and the US came to an end in Pakistan. Jennifer Parker is an adjunct professor at the University of Western Australia's Defence and Security Institute and former naval officer with experience in the Middle East.
Many reports today have said it's a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. That's not correct. That is what President Trump said. However, the Central Command, who is in charge of this campaign, have come out and announced a formal blockade in a notice to mariners, which says they are blockading vessels going to and from Iranian ports, so not the Strait of Hormuz. And this allows them to exert that economic pressure to get some leverage over Iran, but also restrict any resupply of weapon systems into Iran.
She says because the United States is at war with Iran, the blockade should be legal under international law, as long as the US military meets certain conditions.
They need to allow food and other critical supplies to support the civilian population to go in to the port. The second is it needs to be implied impartially, which means applied to all vessels regardless of their flag. And the US have said that. So this isn't a blockade of Iranian vessels. It is a blockade of all vessels going in and out of Iran.
the blockade is likely to end any chance of another round of peace talks. After the summit in Pakistan, the US side said the two nations failed to find a middle ground on issues, including ending Iran's uranium enrichment and reopening the Strait of Hormuz without tolls. Iran says it needs the tolls as reparations for the cost of the war, and it's calling on Israel to stop its invasion and bombing campaign in Lebanon. Emeritus Professor Amin Saikal is a Middle East analyst. He's seeing few signs that either side is ready to make a deal.
It looks like that both sides have painted themselves into a corner from which they cannot really get out without suffering a degree of degradation, political and diplomatic degradation.
He says while the marathon 21-hour talks in Pakistan sound lengthy, in diplomatic terms, that's barely any time at all.
If we recall that 2015 nuclear agreement took something like 2 years to be sorted out or to be signed. And I think probably there is a need for more time for negotiations, therefore an extension of the current ceasefire. And whether that is going to come from President Trump, I think that remains to be seen.
The US blockade of Iranian ports is due to come into force overnight.
Angus Randall. An iron ore mine in the Northern Territory has stood down its workforce, claiming that the global fuel crisis has made its operations unviable. But unpaid contractors, suppliers and workers who are owed hundreds of thousands of dollars say the company had major financial problems well before the price of fuel soared. They're accusing the Northern Territory government of allowing the mine in the Gulf of Carpentaria to trade while insolvent for months. Jane Barden filed this report.
Central Queensland haulage company owner Brendan Haynes supplied vehicles to the NT's Nathan River Resources iron ore mine for 5 months last year. But he, like other contractors, suppliers and staff, says he hasn't been paid.
We started in April 25. That was our second go. And then we left in what would have been August.
How much do you estimate that the company owes you now?
About $218,000, $20,000. We've had to sell two trucks to keep ourselves afloat. Yeah, it's not really a good thing because we're trying to grow our business as a small family-owned business, but we can't really because they obviously ask a heap of money.
The mining company has told its staff in a letter seen by the ABC that they would be stood down without pay, quote, due to the fuel crisis impacting on our operations. Brendan Haynes says that seems implausible because non-payment started well before the US-Iran war.
Well, we carted this iron ore over 12 months ago, so the fuel crisis has definitely got nothing to do with us getting paid.
Brendan Haynes is angry that the NT government allowed the company to keep operating while running up more and more debts.
I think they've been trading insolvent for a fair while.
Governments are meant to make sure that mines are what they call a fit and proper person, that they're properly capitalised, that yep, they've got the money to pay. Do you think the NT government has really failed to do that in this case?
Yeah, I think they have, definitely.
Some of the mine site's workers have told the ABC they've been struggling to get paid for months. This worker, who was there for 2 years until last Christmas, asked to remain anonymous for fear of losing his new job at another company.
Pre-Christmas there, yeah, we didn't get paid for, it was nearly 4 weeks there until Christmas Eve and all of that. And we just kept getting the same old excuse every week. Yeah, you get paid Monday and then Monday comes and then it's Wednesday. And yeah, I just had enough of the zero safety, the zero regard for workers. Yeah, not getting paid. Weren't getting paid super either.
How much in super do you estimate that you haven't been paid?
Between 50 and 80,000, I reckon.
He's alleging that he and other employees made complaints to the NT government's WorkSafe regulator about numerous safety issues at the mine. But after a visit last year, nothing changed.
Safety was just pretty much non-existent there as far as dust inhalation and all of that. The unroadworthy work vehicles, the marine vessels are unsafe, all the belts and everything to load the iron ore onto the barges.
David Hayes from the Electrical Trade Union NT says he's been contacted by several mine employees with similar allegations.
A regulator has been out there, but they gave notice that they were coming, which gave the mine the opportunity to hide all their deficiencies. It's an absolute mess.
The ABC has asked Nathan River Resources to respond to all of these allegations, but has not received a reply. Injured employees on workers' compensation say they told WorkSafe they weren't getting paid months ago. NT WorkSafe hasn't yet responded to the ABC's questions. The Mines Minister, Gerard Maley, sent a statement saying his department is actively working with the company. Senior NT Government Cabinet Minister Steve Edgington batted worker accusations of inaction back to the company.
Look, I don't have the detail around contractors being out of pocket at the moment, but the reports that we have is indicating that there has been a winding back of operations.
He says the miner can't get away with blaming the fuel crisis.
Employees are still entitled to receive their entitlements. What Nathan River Resources needs to be doing is sitting down with their contractors, with their employees, and explaining what the situation is when it comes to cash flow, the impact of the fuel crisis, and how that's affecting the operations of the Nathan River mine.
Northern Territory Government frontbencher Steve Edgington, Jane Barden, with that report. Recruitment is to be a top priority for the new Chief of the Australian Defence Force. The Prime Minister announced today that the head of the Navy, Vice Admiral Mark Hammond, is to take on the role. Rear Admiral Matthew Buckley will be promoted to lead the Navy. And Lieutenant General Susan Coyle will become the first female Chief of the Army. Here's Bridget Fitzgerald.
After a 40-year career in the Royal Australian Navy, Vice Admiral Mark Hammond, AO, has been appointed to lead the nation's defence force. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese described his elevation as the next step in a distinguished career.
Appointed the Chief of Navy in 2022, Vice Admiral Hammond will continue to bring valuable insight to the role of Chief of the Defence Force, including, of course, to Australia's acquisition of conventionally armed nuclear-powered submarines through AUKUS and the delivery of the Navy's future subsurface combatant fleet.
Vice Admiral Hammond thanked the Prime Minister for his trust and vote of confidence.
The responsibilities of the position are not lost on me. This is probably the most humbling moment in my career.
The current serving Deputy of the Navy, Rear Admiral Matthew Buckley, AM, will be appointed to Navy Chief. And Lieutenant General Susan Coyle, AM, Australia's Chief of Joint Capability, will become the Chief of the Army. Richard Marles, the Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Defence, described Lieutenant General Coyle's appointment as historic.
Her achievement means that she will be the first woman to command a service in Australian history. As Susan said to me, you cannot be what you cannot see.
When asked what was the biggest challenge the ADF faces in 2026, Vice Admiral Hammond cited recruitment, while also acknowledging there's been a recent uptick in the number of young people signing up for military service.
The biggest opportunity for the Australian Defence Force going forward is to be seen as an employer of choice that values every member of the team and creates an environment where our people want to get out of bed and go to work because of the important work that we do, how we do it and who we get to work with. I'd suggest that we've made significant progress in that regard.
Between 2024 and 2025, the ADF experienced its highest annual workforce increase in 15 years, bringing the total number of permanent and full-time personnel to more than 61,000. There was a 17% increase in the number of young people who joined, following a targeted advertising campaign on social media and online games. But despite the recent lift in recruitment, the ADF still faces significant challenges. Raylene Lockhorst is the Deputy Director of National Security Programs at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. She says a stable workforce will be vital to delivering the National Defence Strategy and that the ADF will need to improve both recruitment and retention.
the mid-career attrition is the key pressure point. So the ADF's losing personnel at their most experience, and it's the hardest to replace. So drivers in that area are the operational tempo, the housing pressures, family impacts, private sector competition. So I think that's where the public service and the private sector create a little bit more stability to fix those drivers. So, you know, what the ADF needs to do is strengthen the employment offer. What's the pay look like? The housing conditions, posting stability, flexible models, that kind of thing.
Raylene Lockhorst says the appointment of Lieutenant General Coyle to a leadership position is an important step in highlighting the role of women in the ADF.
It's about the ADF being serious about broadening its leadership pipeline and modernising the institutional culture. But I also think she has a really diverse career, which is going to be a role model for both women serving in the ADF and for potential recruits.
The leadership changes will take effect from July.
Bridget Fitzgerald with that report. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. After 16 years in power, Hungary's autocratic Prime Minister Viktor Orbán has been booted from office in the country's weekend election. The new Prime Minister is Péter Modzsor, the leader of the centre-right Tisza Party. Will Partlett is an associate professor at the University of Melbourne Law School. He points out that the European Commission is withholding billions of euros in aid to Hungary because Orbán has refused to comply with EU standards and democratic principles, and he's expecting the new Prime Minister will make significant changes to the way Hungary is governed.
He's going to try to change the court system, put some judges in there that are more to his liking. He's going to try to change the way the electoral system works so it's less stacked in favor of the Fidesz and Orbán's party. So we're going to see some pretty significant changes coming in the coming years with this election result.
Now, Viktor Orbán has described his government or the nation under him as an illiberal democracy. What did that actually mean in practice?
Well, this is a way of him signalling his growing ideological affinity with countries like Russia and China. Also his distaste and some of his supporters' distaste for the European Union, which they view as a kind of liberal system that is not working. So it really was a kind of message and a slogan that was signaling about the position that Hungary would be taking in relation to liberal West versus the authoritarian kind of East in Russia and China.
And the new Prime Minister of Hungary, Modzsor, was formerly a close ally of Viktor Orbán. What can you tell us about him?
Yeah, so he was a member of the Fidesz party, which is Viktor Orbán's party. His ex-wife was actually a member of Viktor Orbán's government. So he has a lot of close ties and relationships with members of Viktor Orbán's party. So he's an insider who defected and has led this populist uprising against his former kind of leader, Viktor Orbán, and has won.
We know that Hungary and Russia have been close allies. How do you think the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, is likely to view the change in leadership in Hungary?
Oh, he'll be disappointed. This is a loss for the Kremlin and for Russia. They have long enjoyed having Viktor Orbán in the EU because Viktor Orbán has been a kind of spoiler for a number of things, including blocking EU funding of the war in Ukraine and supporting the Ukrainian war effort and so forth. So he's been a very supportive ally for the Russians in the EU. So it's a significant loss for the Kremlin, who did try with great effort to ensure that Viktor Orbán would stay in power.
Do you think the new Prime Minister of Hungary, Modzsor, will now try and support Europe in the war in Ukraine?
Yeah, he has signaled that he will be much more willing to support the Ukrainians. And I think in general, he's going to be much more pro-European on rule of law issues as well, because he is very keen on unlocking some of the frozen, I think, up to almost 20 billion euros in frozen money that should be on its way to Hungary. And, you know, one of his central platforms was he would unlock this money so that Hungary can recover, because, you know, the Hungarian economy is not going well. And in fact, that was one of the kind of the key issues that projected that really got him the victory was it was just a cost of living and getting the economy back on track. So I think we are going to see a much more pro-EU administration in Hungary, and that will see significant changes overall. I think in the position of EU will be much stronger, I think, on Europe and on Ukraine.
It's unusual, I think, to see both Russia and the US backing the same candidate in an election. The American Vice President J.D. Vance was in Hungary last week to back Orbán. Why did the Trump administration want to see him re-elected?
Well, I think it's a similar kind of ideological position that J.D. Vance and President Donald Trump take, which is that they also are very suspicious of the EU and the European Union. And J.D. Vance in particular has been very open and vocal in his support of populist right-wing parties across the European landmass. And so this is just another example of them supporting these populist right-wing parties because they push back on the EU and what they view as a kind of woke conception of governance that they view as undemocratic. So it's an ideological affinity, I think, that we're seeing between President Trump and the Vice President Vance and the populist right in Europe.
Associate Professor Will Partlett from the Melbourne Uni Law School. One of the biggest stars of Indian cinema, or Bollywood, Asha Bhosle, has died at the age of 92. After an extraordinary 81-year career, the singer is being remembered as India's Queen of Melody. Performing in more than 20 languages, she was the first Indian artist to be nominated for a Grammy Award. Samantha Joncha prepared this report.
Asha Bhosle started singing at 11 years old. By the time she died on Sunday, at the age of 92, she closed out an eight-decade career as one of the most famous women in India. As a teenager, she made her debut as a Bollywood playback performer, recording songs for films that actresses would lip-sync for the camera. Her music drew millions to the box office. But in this interview with CNN from 2011, she was clear. She was much happier in the studio than in front of the camera.
Some producer asked me, can you work in the film? So I said, no. He said, why? I said, I see my face every morning. So I left.
Pawan Luthra is the publisher of IndiaLink, an Australian-based, India-focused news site.
What defined her was her versatility. She recorded over 12,000 songs in multiple Indian languages. She got the accolade as the most recorded artist in music history. She developed a style that lent towards experimentation, which a lot of singers don't do. She embraced Western influences, cabaret numbers, and rhythm-driven compositions. And she could pour emotion into a ballad. She could bring earthiness to folk and slip effortlessly into pop with a distinctly global sound.
Asha Bhosle was known for voicing the songs of so-called bad girls, complex and bold women, and celebrated for pushing the sound of Bollywood in new directions. In 2007, she told Al Jazeera that she drew inspiration from Western performers.
I like to see English movie when I was very young, and I copied English songs, how they sing, like Catherine Valentina, like Carmen Miranda, or Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, and every artist. I like their style.
She was most influential from the 1950s to 1980s.
She's the voice which filled every room and every party and every late night evening with friends because of the versatility she had. And if you had a big Indian party, she would have the cabaret styles of pop kind of music, which would make everybody dance. So she was an amazing person who would be so much missed.
She made history as the first Indian performer to be nominated for a Grammy in 1997. And collaborated with international artists throughout her career. In 2005, her music featured in the soundtrack for the video game Grand Theft Auto. Hare Krishna, Hare Ram. Hare Krishna, Hare Ram. Hare Krishna, Hare Ram. Asha Bhosle was also sampled by American pop group The Black Eyed Peas.
sab kuch yahan.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi mourned her death on X, calling her one of the most iconic and versatile voices India has ever known. She will continue to inspire generations, and her songs will forever echo in people's lives.
I don't care number and this and that. God gave me everything. People recognize in London, in America. Every good artist, they know me. And my children are very happy. I don't want anything. I'm doing my best to do that best work.
She died on Sunday from a reported heart attack.
Samantha Johncher with that report. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on ABC Listen. And that's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning too. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. The ABC's Alan Kohler thinks the Treasurer should nationalise the childcare system, as concerns remain about the quality, safety and affordability of some centres. Is now the time for a radical shake-up? Today, Alan on if his idea could work, and a childcare policy expert on the case for change. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.